All right, good evening, everyone. Good evening. My name is David McKnight, and I'm the director of the Rare Book and Manuscript Library. Good evening and welcome to the third and final lecture in the 2013 ASW Rosenbach Lectures in Bibliography. Our lecturer, Paul Needham, is the Scheide Librarian at Princeton University. After his first two lectures, Paul has demonstrated why he is, in my opinion, the leading expert on the subject of Johann Gutenberg and the invention of printing using movable type in Mainz during the years 1450 to 1460 and beyond, as we have seen. This was the subject of his first lecture, The 1450s, Bookmaking Inventions, which Paul delivered on Monday evening. During his second lecture on Tuesday evening, The 1460s, Slow Diaspora, Paul again demonstrated his erudition as he examined the gradual spread of printing with movable type beyond Mainz to two other German cities, first Bamberg in 1460 and later Cologne in 1465. He concluded his lecture with his observations regarding the spread of printing presses to Italy, with presses appearing first in Subiaco, just east of Rome in 1465, Rome in 1467, and he concluded his lecture with references to printing appearing in Venice in 1469. This evening, in his final lecture, Paul continues his exploration of the spread of printing in Europe during the ensuing 5 years, concluding with 1475. Please welcome Mr. Paul Needham.
Thank you very much, David, and I'd like to give my thanks really to everybody who works in special collections at Penn and to the rare book catalogers, all of whom have done many helpful things this week, and it's been a pleasure being here. In our second lecture, we progressed to the end of the 1460s and declared a symbolic, but really more than symbolic, milestone with the coming of printing to Venice in 1469 and the figure of John of Speyer. The roughly 20 years of typography surveyed in the first two lectures can be summarized by putting numbers, and not particularly large numbers, to several aspects. The places of printing, the printing shops, the editions printed, the size of those editions as printing jobs. All of these we could keep in our head together without performing any great feat of memory. In essence, we could recognize and visualize every surviving item of printing as if it were an individual, as if together they were the inhabitants of a not very large town. Thus, we can say that through 1469, there were 13 places in Europe where printing was done, where we know it was done, as you see on one of your handouts. Both known places, such as Mainz, Strasbourg, Cologne, Rome, and several regions where we know there was a printing shop, yet we cannot identify a particular town. Likewise, we can say that there were 17 printing shops, though in several of these we cannot identify the owner of the shop. We can say that during these 20 years, just a little over 24 printing fonts were created. And these, of course, are the foundation stones of early typography, and so always worth counting and tracking. Counting fonts is different from listing towns and printing shops. For instance, printing was done in Bamberg by Albrecht Pfister and in Eltville by the Bechter-Münzer brothers, but their respective types, two different fonts, both came from Mainz and, in fact, from Johann Gutenberg's shop. We even know by the happy survival of a monastic letter that when Sweinheim and Penartz departed the monastery of Subiaco for Rome in 1467, they left behind their Subiaco type and other equipment. 4 years later, in 1471, a monk of Subiaco wrote to an abbot in Bavaria that this type and equipment could still be used for printing and suggested that a good use for it would be an accurate breviary to encourage liturgical uniformity in the divine offices carried out in convents of the Melk Reform observance. The Subiaco monk apparently enclosed a sheet of the 1467 City of God to show the quality of the type the Subiaco monastery owned. As for how many editions were printed in this 1450 to 1469 period, we can estimate that about 170 to 180 editions survive, at least in fragments. The one uncertainty is the many fragments of Donatus and, in Dutch prototypography type, the Doctrinale of Alexander de Villadei, which cannot be accurately dated, and it could well be that some of these fragments belong to roughly the first half of the 1470s rather than the 1450s and 60s. We know the varying sizes of these books and broadsides in terms of paper size, format, and number of sheets or vellum sheets per copy, and we can accurately estimate what the work of setting the text was in terms of M's, that is, notional square pieces of type. We also have a very general grasp of the edition sizes of these earliest books, based on Aeneas Sylvius's report of 158 or 180 copies of the Gutenberg Fust Bible, an early and presumably authoritative report that Swinhelm and Panartz's editions were all of 275 or 300 copies, and a colophon of John of Speyer stating that his two editions of Cicero's Familiar Letters were 300 copies each. Finally, though I will speak only in broad terms, we have a full picture of the texts that were selected for publication, so that we can say positively, for instance, that there was a definite market, and especially north of the Alps, for Vulgate Bibles in large format, that there were many buyers, especially in the lower Rhine, of what can be called pastoralia, that is, devotional and instructional texts and confession manuals, useful to priests with cures of souls. And we see reflected in the early printing decisions the unique status of Cicero in European education as the model of Latin prose. Editions of various of his writings were produced and marketed from five of the early printing towns between 1465 and 69, Subiaco, Rome, Venice, Mainz, and Cologne. As a group, these texts selected for multiplication in this primal period were well chosen. Almost all the texts of these early years continued to be reprinted many times in the following decades, or if not the exact text, an equivalent one. When we reach the first half of the 1470s, we need to take a very different approach, for there was a striking upswing in the tempo of printing by every measure. The number of editions printed and sold, the number of places where printing was centralized, the number of shops in those places. Consider by each measure the years 1470 to 75 with the earlier period. In that earlier period, as we've said, there were 13 printing places, six or seven of which were quite short-lived and had gone into hibernation, or nearly so, by 1470. From 1470 to 75, printing was introduced to 65 new towns or places. In the earlier period, we've identified 17 printing shops. In the period 1470 to 75, a good estimate is that there were about 240 definable printing shops that were established. And finally, the comparative output of printed editions. In the earlier period, a decent estimate is of about 180 still surviving editions over 20 years. In the 6 years, 1470 to 75, a reasonable estimate is that about 2,300 to 2,400 still surviving editions were published. One consequence, obvious yet still worth specifying, is that in the first half of the 1470s, the number of people who came in contact with printed books and the printing trade multiplied very greatly. These involvements cover a wide range, from paper makers who had orders for paper, and type makers, to workers in printing shops, of whom there were a great many, investors in printing projects, again a great many, editors, long-distance shippers of printed sheets by sea and river, and on land by cart and pack animal, booksellers, a diverse class at this time that might range from long-established Italian stationers in university towns, such as Pavia or Perugia, to a solitary man, or maybe a man with a servant, leading a mule packed with printed sheets along steep, rutted paths, say from one southern Bavarian monastery to another. And finally, to the buyers and readers, who were given a convenient new way to acquire books, but did not have to adjust in the least their ideas of how to read and consult what they bought. We can say very roughly that the expansion in 6 years was about 12-fold over the preceding 20 years. That often misconstrued term, exponential growth, actually does apply here in the world of European typography in the first half of the 1470s, and only to that period. For the following intervals of 5 or 6 years, we may, yes, speak of growth, but not of exponential growth, unless we're making our exponents considerably less than two. In short, the years 1470 to 75 define a unique and critical period of quantitative change in the European book market. So far in the lectures, I've avoided bringing modern arguments on the broad theme of printing into discussion, but having just said that these years are a singular critical period of expansionary change in the European printed book market, it would be disingenuous not to acknowledge that this falls right into a matrix of arguments revolving around the idea of a printing revolution. Essentially, the question is, can we speak of a printing revolution? And I'll add parenthetically that for me, the concept of revolution does not bring much insight. The motive force for these arguments and discussions has been Elizabeth Eisenstein's 1979, The Printing Press as an Agent of Change. More than any other study, it inaugurated a still-running conversation on European printing as an historical factor with consequence that deserve the attentions of historians of Europe and eventually of the world. The central implication of Einstein's monograph is that European typographic printing was in some sense revolutionary. It created what has been called a communications revolution. And in the years since 1979, a steady flow of responses has come forward, many devoted to the theme of translation from manuscript to print, another expression I personally consider to have quite limited value. In varying degrees and ways, these symposia, articles, also the many reviews of Eisenstein's book, have taken stances on questions that had not been widely discussed before. So there was the virtue of establishing a question that could be teased around like a cat with a mouse. In the past few decades, there has emerged from various hands a kind of gradualist revision of Eisenstein's broad thesis. In my view, this trend has been rather out of balance. That is, factors that seem to count against the thesis have tended to be given greater weight than those that seem to count for it. It's like somebody puts a thumb on the scale. Leaving out the author's names, here's a small anthology of summarizing remarks from eminent scholars writing in dissent to some degree from Eisenstein's thesis. And one wrote, "Reports on the death of the manuscript in the Renaissance period have been greatly exaggerated. There are probably as many manuscripts of the second half of the 15th century as of the first." And then another scholar wrote, "Counter to Eisenstein's claim runs an argument, first carefully constructed by Kurt Bühler, that sees many of the presumed innovations of print culture as already present in scribal culture." And then a third person wrote, "In the early days of printing, opinion was divided as to whether the new invention was an improvement upon manuscript. Erasmus was suspicious of its power to disseminate and perpetuate error, both textual and doctrinal. Others welcomed the prospect of an end to laboriously copying out single books. Texts would henceforth be cheap, plentiful, accessible, beautiful to look at, uniform, secure from destruction, improvable." Fourth, to enhance Eisenstein's claims for an immediate revolutionary impact of the new mechanical method of producing codices, All manner of assertions have been made that violate the experience of codicologists and analytical bibliographers. And fifth, very briefly, the printing revolution took shape only gradually. To that one, I'd just say, if it's gradual, why do you call it a revolution? These remarks are by five scholars whose work I admire, but they do not seem to me, singly or in combination, to do any useful work. To each remark, a significant counter-response comes immediately to mind. Take the citation of Erasmus as a doubter about the value of printing. This exemplifies to perfection the danger of argument by anecdote, and especially anecdotes that drop a famous name. The printed word was so critical to Erasmus's own persona that whatever doubts he may have expressed somewhere about the virtues of printing must immediately be measured in some way against a flood of other evidence working in the opposite direction, and indeed against the entire trend of his life and intellectual career. In fact, this invocation of the figure of Erasmus as an emblem of doubts on printing frustrates me in precisely the same way that Eisenstein's book frustrated me. That is, the quick desire to make a rhetorical point rather to engage deeply in a well-shaped historical question. When these gradualist responses are concatenated, they suggest that each author has been working from his or her own undefined, very possibly unformulated picture of the 15th century or of the 15th and 16th centuries or 15th, 16th, 17th centuries. The scale is way too large and too nebulous. We need to acquire a narrower focus. Let us try then very briefly to give some shape to the book world of 15th century Europe. Then into that shape, we can try to assess what printing brought to the book world in the third quarter of the century, with special attention to those last years of the quarter of 1470 to 75. By my argument, these are the years when the contribution of printing to the needs of the book world expanded so rapidly that if the word revolution is applicable at all, and I don't really care whether it is, these are the years worth discussing. This is where to make your arguments. And I believe it is plausible to argue that because of printing, the book world, yes, that too is a rather nebulous concept, was distinctively different in 1475 from what it was in 1469. And your handouts, you might want to sort of ponder them at this moment. Consider handwritten books and their making across 15th century Europe. And we're very free to make our picture here, since no useful history of the 15th century handwritten book exists. As a craft, of course, these handwritten books lie within a quite ancient tradition, but the 15th century is an age of significant changes in that tradition. Perhaps most conspicuously, an important new book hand was developed, and indeed self-consciously created, the humanist hand, in its typographical transmutation, what we call Roman type. And more than just that script, a distinct form and layout of humanist book was developed. We do not seem to have a very good idea of what proportion of books written in the 15th century could be called humanist books, humanist in the sense most carefully defined by Albert Derulet. In the first quarter of the century, they were rare and local to Florence. Their fashion began to strengthen and to move outside Florence, particularly to Rome and the Curia, in the later years of the 1420s. Handwritten humanist books make up an important class of the 15th century, but still a minority one, of the 15th century book, but still a minority one, though it was one of particular prestige. When we take all of Europe into account, the Gothic book, which had its own aesthetic, remained dominant. And here you must take note of another book hand development of the 15th century, for like the humanist hand, it also had an influence in early type making, so far almost completely unstudied. In Northwest Europe, roughly the Lower Rhine, a modified Gothic hand developed, which the paleographer Gerrit Leeftink, who first studied it, called the hybridist script. Although less conspicuous than humanist script, it was well integrated into the bookmaking tradition of its region in the 15th century. And in my first lecture, I mentioned this with regard to printing, but the slide I thought was in my PowerPoint was not there. And so here it is. This is the Cyprus Indulgence issued by Pope Nicholas V, valid until the end of April 1455. This is the indulgence form printed in Mainz in the shop of Johann Fust in early 1455 and intended to be marketed primarily in the Archdiocese of Cologne, the home of the hybrid script. So the font was created just for this indulgence form to meet the expectations of that region. And this is a slide of a very well-preserved copy. It's extremely rare. This copy was issued in Cologne. You might see the word Coloniae there on the 27th of February, 1455. And there's the XXVII, and there's Februarii. Yes, it will go away. Then on the next slide, this is taken from a photograph of another copy of that indulgence, which was actually destroyed in World War II, or at least lost and has never been found. This is one of the few copies, one of one or two, I can't remember which was not sold in the Archdiocese of Cologne, but rather to the Benedictines of Hildesheim in Lower Saxony. And by the way, these things, I mean, you can refer to indulgences being sold, but here's a nice little annotation about the monks of Hildesheim. They contributed to the chest according to their conscience. And it being Hildesheim in Lower Saxony, that was not the home of hybrid script, but rather of a more common textura. And these words, it's not so clear because it's from a photograph, were written in fulfillment. And there's the religiosi of the convent, including Helmold, the abbot, and others. And you see, this is not hybrid script. It has like a two-story A, the L, stops on the line. Compare that within the text itself to like the A in Atque. And here this word, commissa, and the double S fattened, slightly sloped, descending below the line. Those are primary features of the so-called hybrid script, which is a real script form. That is, people consciously wrote it. Alongside the development of the distinctively humanist book, most commonly written on vellum, the 15th century can at the same time be thought of as the age, the century of the triumph of the paper book. This, of course, is a development that cuts indifferently right across the boundary line between handwritten and typographic book production. Over the course of the 15th century, paper moved decisively from being a common text support alongside vellum to becoming the dominant text support, aside from some fairly restricted classes of bookmaking, and that includes early printing, because we noted how many of the books that Fust and Schoeffer, in particular, printed in the late 1450s, early 1460s, were either entirely on vellum or predominantly on vellum. The classes of book that continue to use vellum extensively include the best humanist books, heavily used school books such as Donatus and the Doctrinale of Alexander de Villadei, portable prayer books, that is, particularly books of hours, liturgical books, and of course, specially commissioned luxury books of every kind, including vernacular texts. But the luxury manuscripts of the 15th century are disproportionately conspicuous to our minds because they have been so much more frequently studied and reproduced. I would guess, I actually have the raw data to do better than guess. I was busy writing the lecture instead of data mining. I would guess that perhaps only one in every seven or eight surviving 15th century handwritten books were on vellum, the remainder being on paper. The early 21st century is a good time to be thinking about the 15th century book in global terms, both handwritten and printed. We can begin to become quantitative in a well-reasoned way and without months and months of labor gathering some information. The online versions of the Incunable Short Title Catalog and GW, the Gesamtkatalog der Wikingerdrucke, let us find quickly almost every recorded item of 15th century printing. And these listings include quite extensive, if not fully digested, censuses of the surviving copies. Reliable descriptions of those surviving copies as to localizing features such as ownerships, rubrication, possible illumination, and bindings must be searched for more laboriously from many more sources. But here, too, online descriptions and digitizations are proliferating. Our tools have never been stronger, faster, and easier to use. For handwritten books of the same century, one tool in particular has been growing considerably, the International Series of Dated Manuscript Volumes. I've looked quickly at almost all the volumes, more intensively at some of them, and have brief records on nearly 11,000 handwritten texts whose scribes explicitly dated them in the 15th century. And one page of your handout just arranges those dates from 1401 through 1500, the number of examples belonging to those years. And when I finish pillaging a half dozen or so of the most recently published volumes of Italian collections, the total will go over 11,000. These manuscripts are represented in libraries of the Netherlands, Belgium, France, England, Switzerland, Austria, Germany, Scandinavia, and Italy. Spain is the chief lacuna, also the United States. The year-by-year results of this march through the 15th century are on this graph, which has been handed out to you. The quantity of information is large enough that we can postulate that it reflects with general accuracy the real tempo of making books by handwriting in the 15th century. This depends on the degree to which books with scribal dates are an adequate sample for the much larger number of handwritten books without scribal dates. I actually don't have the handout. Could I borrow just so I don't seem to be fumbling completely? I am assuming that they're adequate for this purpose, but I'm going to bring up two authorities right away. I'm relying partly on the authority of one of the most learned and imaginative students of the late medieval book, Peter Gumbert, who in 1980, basing his opinion on a considerably smaller body of data, expressed confidence that the dated manuscripts can serve as proxy sample for the whole body of 15th century manuscript books. He was sufficiently confident to feel justified in characterizing the last quarter of the 15th century as marking what he called the retreat of the handwritten book. And another paleographer of equal eminence, Gerhard Povitz, has agreed with this. My sample is well over six times the size of the one that Gumbert used, and geographically much more broadly based. And so I believe we see this retreat even more clearly. We can go to a finer scale and think about handwritten book production over five-year rather than quarter-century intervals. On your handout, look especially at the interval covering 1473 to 75, and those stacks have been identified with dates, and I think you're able to infer that the one in between is 1474. Now here we find, just looking at the height of our stacks, here we find the proper response to that gradualist statement that I quoted, that there are probably as many manuscripts of the second half of the 15th century as of the first. If the sample of dated manuscripts is a valid indicator, yes, there are more manuscripts of the second half of the 15th century than of the first. But this is due entirely to the peak occurring from roughly 1450 to 72. In 73 and after, there comes a sharp drop-off. And again, as I say, I'm postulating this expresses reality. These little columns show something that actually happened in the 15th century. There is much more to be done with this large sample of 15th century dated manuscripts. Virtually every one is partially reproduced in the dated manuscripts volumes, so that we can usually visualize quite clearly what each of these dated manuscripts looks like in terms of script and layout. And we always know whether they are on paper or vellum or that small hybrid group where maybe the outer bifolia are vellum and the inner paper. And I have hundreds of notes on those sort of hybrid vellum paper manuscripts. An important further investigation, but one which cannot be done quickly, is into the specific texts that were written and dated, and that really needs to be done. Especially when we move to the texts written from about 1475 to the end of the century, a question always to be considered is, had that text already been printed? And if so, how many editions, and where and when, and what were the selling areas of those editions? For instance, in the Lorenziana in Florence, there are something like 24 manuscripts with dates from the late 1480s to 1490 and a little after. These were all written on commission by several scribes for the King of Hungary, Matthias Corvinus, who was deeply influenced by Italian Renaissance culture and formed in Buda a splendid library in fine bindings of humanist books. This particular group of dated books stayed in Florence because Matthias died in the spring of 1490 before he could pay for them. Essentially, every one of them is a major classical or patristic text that had already been printed multiple times, and the various scribes would surely have used printed editions as their exemplars. As one surveys this large group of 15th century dated manuscripts, one is struck by how unprofessional most of them are, and how diverse and diversely spread their scribes seem to be. There's a little subgroup, for instance, of Italian scribes who record that they wrote the manuscript while they were in prison. Within this large mass, taking advantage of the time available, within this large mass, organized scriptoria are as good as never discernible. Now there's some things one could say to that about that in response to that. The much stronger picture that emerges is along the lines, if you want a book, you better write it yourself. In the mass, these manuscript books seem predominantly to be written in cursive hands, not formal and careful book hands, and on paper, not parchment. They may have a ruled text area, but seldom a ruled lineation. Many were written by members of religious orders, but clearly not in scriptoria. These characteristic 15th century manuscripts, that is a large group of these, are closer to being texts written within private notebooks for consultation by just one person, the writer, than they are to being books in some professional sense. As these handwritten books begin to retreat in the mid-1470s, consider the nature, the typographic books that are, quite obviously, the cause of that retreat. Leaving aside their technology, the printed books enter the market in a very different way from handwritten books. They are not single books, but masses of copies, all finally completed on a particular day in a particular printing shop and needing right away to be sold. In his first book, printed in Bruges in 1473, we'll see a slide in just a little bit, the first English printer, William Caxton, made a riddle out of this, writing that all the books, by which he meant copies, thus imprinted, as ye hear see, were begun in one day and also finished in one day. Of course, it took months to print this particular book of 350-some leaves. For substantial books, as we have already noted, the printers and investors had to lay out considerable money in advance of completion, or at least make financial arrangements to pass on the debt to be redeemed later. Systems of distribution had to be developed that went far beyond the system that an Italian stationer, say, might have for finding individual customers for handwritten books that were in his stock. In a few minutes, in fact, at the conclusion of the lecture, we will consider a few documents to throw very interesting light on this question of the distribution of printed books. As for the constantly rehearsed theme from manuscript to print, for readers who were acquiring books both before and then during the 1470s, I think there's no reason to suppose that they were ever thinking deeply about the differences between the two forms of book they were buying. The single buyer, whose acquisitions we can follow most closely in this period, was named Hilprand Brandenburg, a Swabian cleric born in 1442. He was a canon of Stuttgart and the holder of various other church benefices that gave him sufficient income to indulge his love of books. He spent his last years in the early 16th century in retirement at the Carthusian convent of Buxheim near Memmingen, where he built a special library room and bequeathed his roughly 450 volumes, as well as many other benefactions. A considerable number of these, about 160, have been specifically recorded or tracked down and can be arranged chronologically. Some 38 of them are handwritten, the remainder printed. Of the handwritten books, 13 of them contain scribal dates, and these extend from 1446 to 1469. None goes into the 1470s. Of the printed books, the earliest date is a copy of the magnificent 1462 Bible of Fustin Schoeffer, and Hilprand also acquired three or four other books printed in the 1460s in this primordial period, and then with steady buying, continuing through the 1470s into the 1480s, and then his buying lessened. I think we can say that for this particular bibliophile who had his coat of arms, a woodcut coat of arms, who had his coat of arms painted in many of his earliest printed books, not that is what you were looking at here, for Hilprand, the question of a transition from handwritten to hit printed books did not have to be problematized in any way. He liked the new kind of book and he began buying. Now, I said he had his coat of arms painted with other illumination in many of his printed books from the early years, for instance, that 1462 Bible, Fustin Schoeffer. But then he went to a rather elegant but more economical system of having a woodcut book plate cut for him, incorporating his arms, supported by an angel. And this was pasted in almost all of his books, except that many of them were taken out because bookplate collectors liked to buy them. In Germany in the 1890s, in the bookplate collecting fad, this was treated as perhaps the earliest printed woodcut bookplate, and it may not be the earliest, but it's certainly one of the earliest. This is the flyleaf of one incunable he owned. You can see on it, this happened at Buxheim. The title of the work was written, the titulus, Prima Pars Summae, and then somebody added Theologiae Beate Tomae de Aquino. They wrote the word contenta. That's what usually was filled in if the book was what's called a Sammelband, or that is with various printed editions all bound in the volume, or a single edition that's a collection of tractates, and then the tractates would be written out. The gift inscription was written in Buxheim, and here is the reason that so many people gave good books to monasteries at this time. Book of the Carthusians in Buxheim near Memmingen, coming from our confrater, Hilprand Brandenburg of Biberach, where he was bound, containing the first part of the Summa Theologiae of Thomas of Aquinas. Pray for him and for those whom he loves or wishes to be prayed for. But this is Hilprand's own handwriting from before the books went to Buxheim. This is much rarer, and it's wonderful in this copy to have his own autograph preserved. Dominus Hillenbrandus, is the lord of this book, Quius Libri Dominus. Anybody who finds it, give it back to him. So he was concerned. That's how Hilprand looked at early printed books, and he bought a lot of them. He'd also bought a lot of manuscripts when they were what was easily to be gotten. Nor do we have significant evidence that to any other book connoisseur of this transitional period, the first printed books appeared as odd or threatening or even as inferior, and nor do we have any evidence that printed editions encountered significant opposition of a kind that impeded their progress. From earliest days, in the eyes of the most competent observers, typographic printing was seen as a wondrous, beneficial, God-given invention. Recall the remarks from the cited in the first lecture of the humanist, sort of the arch-humanist, Aeneas Sylvius, when he saw choirs of the Gutenberg Fust Bible while at the Frankfurt Imperial Diet in the fall of 1454. Physically and as a readable text, it was a wonderful book. Its production in so many copies was prodigious. Its inventor was a miracle worker. A similar significance are remarks made, they've been mostly overlooked, remarks made by Leon Battista Alberti, writing in 1466 or so in his tractate on ciphers, on ciphering. As he sat with his friend Leonardo Dati in the Papal Gardens, Alberti reports, the two of them vehemently praised the German inventor of printing, who had made it possible in these times to, he gave his example, to use no more than three men over 100 days to print more than 200 copies of a substantial book. And I'm thinking he probably had in mind one of the Subiaco books. With a single impression, Alberti noted, a large sheet of text could be completed, a large page of text, really. Alberti, you will recall, was more than a learned humanist, though he was that. He was an artist, architect, creator, who was fascinated by technical processes of every kind. As for his friend, Leonardo Dati, we mentioned him in the second lecture. He's the person who, in November 1467, bought in Rome a copy of the 1467 Subiaco City of God, a copy recently brought to Rome by Swinham and Pinarts, who moved the printing operation there. Almost all the early literary responses to typography fall into three categories. First, printed books were produced with something like magical speed. As much was printed in a day as a man could write in a year. The Rome printer Ulrich Hahn often included this statement in his colophons and other versions. This was most vividly expressed in 1473 by a printer in Parma who wrote in the colophon of one of his books, The Achilleus of Statius, that it had all been finished more quickly than asparagus is cooked. Citius quam asparagi cocunter. This is a vernacular saying from ancient Rome that, according to Suetonius, was a favorite saying of Emperor Augustus. Second, printed books were cheaper than manuscripts. The Swinham and Panarts editor and patron Giovanni Andrea Bussi was the first to assert this, one of his several formulations being that one now could pay for an entire book what you used to have to pay just for the binding. And Bussi did have some sort of engaged knowledge of this, not just as a buyer, but as a scribe. In his early years, before the benefices began to amass, Bussi had had to earn money as an expert scribe, and several of the books he wrote have survived. And one of them has a colophon saying how long he took to write it, and it seems like really extraordinary speed. So maybe he was just working hard to get his payment as quickly as possible. And then the third statement that one finds very widespread in various versions is that printing was a German miracle. What a surprise it was, especially for Italians, that this vigorous but barbaric race should have brought forth an invention that so strikingly aided the world of letters. It does seem unbelievable, doesn't it? In Paris in 1471, the humanist rector of the Sorbonne, Guillaume Fichet, expressed this with military imagery. The German printers, he wrote, were like the Greeks and the Trojan horse, who materialized out of nowhere and spread in all directions. And he himself had recently brought three printers from southern Germany to work for him on commission at the Sorbonne, and they produced a long series of humanist classical texts. Again, we'll look at a slide of one in just a few minutes. To return specifically to our core period, 1470 to 75, so much changes and so quickly in the printing and publishing world during these years that the period really cannot be characterized in any simple way. We can give brief attention only to one or two significant themes, while others of equal significance, such as the development of printing in Hebrew and in Greek, will have to be left to the side. And one theme that is the rapid increase in the number of texts that became available in printed form. Here there is much really useful analysis waiting to be done. The topic is very under-discussed. That is, the number of editions just by number increased massively. In that year 1470, about as many editions were printed as in all the years preceding it. But more than that, the first half of the 1470s is when the range of texts set in type began, as one might say, to cover the field, or to cover the field in Latin, at least. With each year, the fundamental works used, for instance, by the academic faculties came rather steadily into print. The earlier large projects of the 1450s and 60s, mentioned in the first two lectures, did not come close to covering that field. For example, the sentences of Peter Lombard, the central text of theology faculties, was not printed until 1471 in Strasbourg at the press of Heinrich Eggestein. And then when you say it's printed there, you immediately have to wonder, and so where was it sold? It'd be rather unlikely that those copies were sold to Paris, for instance, with its most famous theology faculty. And likewise, before the 1470s, almost none of the writings of Aristotle that occupied so much of the arts curriculum, the baccalaureate curriculum of the universe, almost none of those had, of the universities, almost none of those had come into print. As these major texts did become available in multiple printed copies, the number of texts that needed handwriting to make new copies steadily receded. It is probably this factor above all that makes the retreat of the handwritten book track so closely in the first half of the 1470s with the increase in printed editions. Of course, the making of handwritten books did not cease, especially one suspects this holds for books of hours before the late 1480s, when several Paris printing shops began to make a specialty of producing high-quality illustrated horae and had tremendous success in that market. But the gradualists who emphasize this manuscript making with a sort of solemn, let us not, however, overlook the fact that manuscripts did not simply lie down and die, seemed to me to be overlooking this central point, that the supply of texts available in print expanded very rapidly within the 5 years just mentioned and then kept on expanding. And of course, that affected decisions to have new copies made by hand. How could it not? Naturally, there was no central authority trying to organize the selection of texts that were printed. The 1470s are also years when multiple editions of the same work came into rather disorderly competition. A striking example is the first printing of Dante's Commedia. In 1472, shops in three different printing towns, Venice, Mantua, and probably first of all, Foligno, farther to the south, that's what we're seeing here, independently decided within just a few months to print the Commedia, each, of course, drawing on a different manuscript as setting copy. This is the one treated as the Editio Princeps, printed in Foligno. And here's the name of the printer, Io Maestro Giovanni Neumeister. That's supposed to be Terza Rima verse, by the way. Neumeister is a very interesting figure. He printed in a number of different places, and although it's circumstantial evidence, there's a pretty good chance that he was a worker in Johann Gutenberg's shop in Mainz. But he went to Foligno, and he got together with this man, Fulgenato Evangelista, to come together to print the edition of the Commedia. He did a little printing in Foligno and then moved on. In fact, he went back to Mainz and did printing there. And then he moves to southern France, to Albi, and did further printing there, dying a pauper in the south of France. Another of those 1472 editions of Dante is here. It doesn't say it's printed in Venice, but we know that the printer Federico of Verona, whose name you see there, was in Venice at that time on the 1472, on the 15th calends of August, that is roughly the middle of July. I don't remember the exact date. And then in Mantua, the same thing, the difference being that it's a smaller type and printed in double columns. And here is 1472. Here are the printers, Magister Georg and Magister Paulus Teutonici, Germans, printed this book with the help of Colombino of Verona, who is known as a schoolmaster and presumably was more or less the editor and overseer of the printing. As for the spread of printing to new towns in these years, and you have a list of them all, it can be proposed that this expansion is essentially the expression of hope of many different people. To many investors, including, for instance, the South German trading associations that brought printing to Spain, it would have seemed in these years that printing had exciting prospects before it that could bring both honor and profit. But hope necessary to human progress is flighty, and the fate of many of the early printing shops, especially those in smaller towns lying off major trading routes, is summed up in a parable that some of you may know that says that a sower went out to sow his seed. And as he sowed, some seed fell by the wayside, it was trodden down, or the fowls of the air devoured it, and some upon a rock, and as soon as it sprang up, it withered away, and some fell among thorns, and the thorns smothered it, and only some fell on good ground and sprang up, and that bare fruit a hundredfold. Well, just change seeds to printing shops, and you have the general situation of the 1470s. In fact, expansion of the printing trade and consolidation of the printing trade ran just together in the 1470s, and especially the first half. Of the 13 printing towns before 1470, six continued through the remainder of the century to have active printing trades, and the others did not. I've vaguely tried to indicate this in your chart by bolding some of the names of towns, the towns that were really prominent throughout the 15th century. Of the 65 new towns from 1470 to 75, half of them were ephemeral or very close to ephemeral, producing just a few books in a year or just a few years, sometimes only a single book, followed in by hibernation that lasted until maybe some new shop tried again to establish itself there, the 16th century, or even in the 17th century, or not at all. To cite just one example on your handout, look at Matelica under the year 1473, a small town in the marches of Italy within the Papal States at this time. A single book, surviving in a single copy, is known to have been printed in that year, A Life of the Virgin by Antonio Cornazzano. The colophon names the printer, Bartolomeus de Columnis, Bartolomeo Colonna, born on the island of Chios off the coast of Turkey. And Chios then was controlled precariously by the Republic of Genoa, and it managed to hold out against the Ottomans until the 1560s. The colophon also names the rulers of Metellica, the brothers Antonio and Alessandro Ottoni, whose palace, I believe, still survives there. And they must have been the patrons who took on the costs of printing. And By happy chance, we have a little clue about this, because when Alessandro died in 1487, a post-mortem inventory was made and survives, and it lists among his goods, where they list books that he owned, Più quinterne della vita della nostra donna, that is, many quires of the life of Our Lady. And these must be unsold copies of the 1473 venture. There was nothing wrong with the choice of text. More than a dozen early editions are known of Cornezzano's Life of the Virgin. It's frequently printed in Venice, good place to print it. But Metellica was clearly rocky or thorny ground. Venice, above all other places, was fruitful ground. In the years 1470 to 75, about 36 printing shops were set up there, twice as many in one city in those years as in the entire first two decades of printing in 13 different places. But there too, in fact, though I don't have time to go into this, the ground was both fruitful and rocky, because many of those shops also had short lives. And we're going to, again, have just a little bit of an intermezzo here, looking at colophons of some of the books printed in these years. I took a number of them out of my PowerPoint because it just seemed there wasn't much to say about them. But here, since we've mentioned Matthias Corvinus, here is the first book printed in Buda in the year 1473. German, I think he was German or German-Hungarian, the printer Andreas Hess, who only printed one more book there, and then he disappears, finished. It's a chronicle of Hungary. This chronicle was used by Hartmann Schedel when he was compiling his World Chronicle, 1473, on the eve of Pentecost. Have to show something of William Caxton, and this is one page of the first book he printed in English in Bruges, so on the continent of Europe. Although this is a copy has had a hard life, you see it's a rather ambitious piece of printing, for instance, with the section titulus printed in red. A very interesting type that I won't go into, but the font is what's generally called Bastarda or Burgundian Bastarda, and is really, that was a prestige script for vernacular book in the Low Countries, and Caxton, so to speak, passed it on for English readers. And they accepted it. Let's see. Go away. But this is literally, as people are always saying these days, literally the first piece of English printing. This is literally the first piece of printing in France, printed by Guillaume. I better stop right there. Printed in France, in that press of the Sorbonne of Guillaume Fichet, an Italian humanist text, the letters of Gasparino Barzizzi, which were good models for letter writing, and with a nice colophon and couplets, praising, basically, Paris, you are so fortunate that printing has been brought here. And here are the names of the printers who printed it. Odoricus, they misspelled his name. Their names are Gering Krantz and Freiburger, their surnames, who printed this, and they will print more. So for the first book, I guarantee you're going to get more of this. Here, this is not the first piece of printing, but I just have to show it. It's a bloodletting calendar printed in Augsburg by Günther Zeiner, mentioned in the second lecture, first printer of Augsburg. He printed this very elegant, this is binding waste, and so there's some trimmed loss, bloodletting calendar for the year 1472. What's interesting about it is here's his colophon, and it has this lovely expression in it. In the city of Augsburg, this was made by Günther Zeiner, Ne Italo Cadere Vidiamor, that we seem to surrender nothing to the Italian. What he means by that is that he made a Roman font, a humanist font, and he printed this bloodletting calendar, not the first thing that would come to your mind is something that needs a humanist font. He printed it, so this is like also a display piece of, you hear all about the Germans. He probably meant particular Nicholas Jensen in Venice, but we here in Bavaria, we can do good things too. And many of the early colophons are just fascinating in the expressions that come out of them. And, yeah, and then we'll go to here. I'm going to close by looking at travails of one successful Venice publisher whose bad experience with a traveling bookseller whom he took on created a small group of documents that open up to us the complex realities of what remains the most unexplored aspect of early printing, the distribution and selling of books. The publisher in question is John of Cologne, who had an equal partner in all documents and colophons. They say, you know, we're together. We do everything together. We love each other. Everything is equal. And they were also John Manthan, and also in extremely close connection with the printer Wendelin of Speyer, who continued the printing shop of John of Speyer when John so happily died in late 1469. What I show here is the colophon of John of Speyer's last book, the big Editio Princeps of Pliny's Natural History. And 1469, and it has a very interesting colophon. You see his little humanist symptom here of using the ampersand also for et at the end of words, haberet. And here's his name, and he's basically saying, you know, you could hardly find this book at all, that is the Natural History of Pliny, and now I've made it available to the Venetians. And then he says, he's just really rubbing it into the scribes, saying basically, put down your tired hands and let the reed sit, because your labor now has to give away to genius, that is printing. And so he was not trying to make friends with the scribes around him. In any case, John of Cologne joined this printing shop as a major investor. And the way he did it was he married Donna Paola, the widow of John of Speyer. And so this became her third marriage. And in fact, she went on to a fourth marriage, also to a German printer at the end of the 1470s. Well, in the summer of 1471, John of Cologne gathered together a group of 234 Venetian books, that is, multiple copies of a smaller number of titles. And we have a list of them, and it even says that some of them are naked, meaning unrubricated, some are miniato, some have illumination added to them, a small group, so that they could be offered in a couple of different ways. And most notable on the list are many Cicero and other classical Latin texts. Some had been printed by Wendelin of Speyer, others by other Venetian shops, including that of Nicholas Jensen, which really did produce the most beautiful printing. And John of Speyer consigned these to a German priest named Sigismund Recklinger, who was to take them north into Bavaria and sell them at agreed minimum prices. At some point in the late summer or early fall, Recklinger must have returned to Venice, but without either most of the money he contracted to bring, or with the unsold copies, and that created a big problem. John of Cologne strongly suspected that Recklinger had sold many of the books and pocketed the money, hidden it somewhere. He had Recklinger arrested and put into the new prison of San Marco. And there are some statements by Recklinger where he declared that he could easily prove his innocence, and he was perfectly happy to remain in prison until all was cleared up. But in fact, a few days later, he escaped from prison and was never seen again. But John of Cologne had already begun proceedings against Recklinger in the court of the Patriarch of Venice. And among the evidence he entered, still preserved, is both an inventory of the books signed for by Recklinger and a letter that Recklinger had written to him from Regensburg in August of 1471 on a certain day. And in that letter, Recklinger made many excuses for his failures so far to sell all the books, or at least to get the agreed prices for each. He said that he'd collected 200 ducats in sales so far, but he found when he got to Regensburg that there were many other booksellers there, coming from Mainz and Augsburg and Nuremberg, and they created strong price competition. Well, some of this, I think, was embroidered, but Mainz, Augsburg, and Nuremberg were indeed three very major German printing towns at this time. That leaves out Strasbourg, which would be the fourth. Recklinger then went, he said. He left Regensburg, and he, in company with the secretary of a German Marcus, he went to Nuremberg, where Emperor Frederick and his court were then temporarily staying. And he said that there he had found one person who offered to buy all the remaining books for 240 florins, which obviously was much less than the agreed minimum price of all of them put together. However, Recklinger did suggest that if John Cologne would send north to him some more books, editions of church fathers not yet to be found in Germany, he thought he could find buyers for those. And I suspect this is the point when John of Cologne decided to pull the plug. In any case, John of Cologne had made private inquiries in Bavaria, and he'd gotten a strong indication that at least some of these books Recklinger had sold to the parish priest of a small town in the Diocese of Passau with a value of so many ducats and so many Rhine florins. These were the ones that he could almost lay his hands on. And so John of Cologne requested that a letter be sent in the name of the Patriarch of Venice to the Bishop of Passau asking for help in getting the money. And he said in that any money that was gotten should be sent to a certain citizen of Steyr in Austria, obviously a person with whom John of Cologne had an existing business relationship. We don't know if anything ever came of that. Here is a book of the kind that was sent north to sale. Venice, 1471, Cristoforo Mauro is the doge. He actually died in November of 1471, so we know it's before that date. At the expenses, the cost of John of Cologne, ex Colonia Agrippinense. And the survival of the documents that relate to this failed attempt to sell books to Germany from Venice, and that was a major selling area for the Venetian printers. The survival of such documents is always more or less a happy accident. And it's unfortunate that the Italian documents in particular, of which there are a considerable number, are so disparate and often obscurely published in local history journals or small 19th, even some 18th century pamphlets. A corpus of documents relating to the Italian printed book trade of the 15th century is a major desideratum. Beyond their specific details, what the documents in sum reveal is what a complex world of human and business interactions typically is hidden behind the colophon of a book, such as the one that here just gives you the name of John of Cologne. It doesn't even mention Bindenullen of Speyer, who printed the book. Perhaps, indeed, to study these early years of European printing, One of the things we must bring to our task is the mindset of an arachnologist who loves to look at spiderweb strands and try to infer the spiders who wove them. Thank you. Come on. There we go.
Okay. Thank you very much, Paul. Do we have questions for Paul?
The sound?
Hi. Thank you so much for that. That was very enlightening. And as someone who works in publishing and does course adoptions, I was quite interested when you were talking about the Aristotle texts and how perhaps their availability as print editions made it much more convenient to create more and more of them. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about that in particular, or other, maybe other kind of primary texts that were starting to be used by universities at the time.
Well, it isn't just the universities. I mean, just also texts that were very widely read. It's just that, you know, those first two decades of printing, going through 1469, I suggested, and I think it's right, that the way to think of that is the time of individual projects. And the printers who formed had the idea that they would pay for this, and they would pay for something else, and they would pay for something else. They would do it as they got their funding, and then they would have a specific selling campaign for one book. I suggested there that there's really one, really just one notable exception to that, and that's the first printer of Cologne, Ulrich Zell, who really had a different program, one of selling small books, mostly pamphlet size, all in quarto format, all using the same type, very similar layouts. And he found success with a sort of a running financing of his books, rather than one large investment, one large hope, and then let's plan another book, maybe a year, maybe two, maybe even 3 years later. And so if one wants to study, say, Aristotle editions, especially the ones used in schools, yes, indeed, one could do it. It'd be a very useful thing to do. And the 1470s is where you would begin and continue on. And there's just, a ton to do. For instance, bare text versus commentated text, just so on and so forth. It's a big, rather promising field.
Thank you. How was it possible that so much more paper was produced between 1474 and 75 and on? It's such a big jump in production. And how is it distributed as well?
Yeah, well, you know, we don't know a lot about that. As for distribution, we do know something. I mean, that is, you know, we have the paper. If you have the book, you have the paper. And so you can fit the watermarks of any particular book into what's a slightly scattered, but in fact quite rich body of data about roughly where the paper mills were. It's pretty rare that you know just where one was. But and so paper coming north over the Alps through a couple of channels, I mean, absolutely that happened. It started with the Gutenberg Bible. It kept on going. Paper made in Genoa, some of it was exported to England, and William Caxton printed on it. Almost all the printing in Spain was done with Genoese paper. I mean, one very early document trying to set up a printing shop in Spain. I better not guess the city, though. I think it was Segovia. A lot of plans were made, and then the entire project fell through because one of the participants in the contract was a Genoese paper maker, and he just never delivered the paper. So ready to print, but the paper never came. Well, paper mills obviously became much more busy, but records of them for this period basically do not survive at all. So you have to infer from the physical paper.
Can I just pick up on Jamie's question, because I thought that was really interesting. I mean, the question of, is it really the case that most of the printers up to 1470 are not publishers? They're just printing and they're finding money elsewhere, you know, from a variety of sources. And that then in the 1470s, you begin to get printers who are publishers, who are actually speculative.
Or, you get a lot of, you get a class of people who can be called publishers. And sometimes their names are in colophons, often their names are not in colophons. From printing contracts and other documents, and more survive from Italy and Spain than anywhere else. If you added up, just wrote down the number of names of people involved in the contracts, and then you wrote down the books that were printed, the names that are in the colophons, you have four times as many or five times as many names in the contracts. And that's why the survival of any of them is so interesting. For those early printers, such as Peter Schiffer, Johann Mentelin in particular, we do have a couple of survivals of broadside lists of books that they had for sale, which clearly were taken by, well, like the accursed Johann Rechlinger for John of Cologne. They were given a group of books and they were sent out to different places to try and sell the books on the spot. And some of those printed broadsides, of course, they're desperately rare. You know, even say at the bottom, come to this inn. And so it was something meant to be posted, and then you could write in the name of the inn. I know one of them does have the name of the inn, but not of the city. Some of them are blank. But it does give you a very interesting picture of, you know, southern Germany and into Austria. There was a lot of book buying, but you don't have towns with stationers in them. It was much more do-it-yourself for the printers of the books to just get the books taken to these places.
Again, thank you so much for all three lectures. You said that you hadn't really had time to do data mining of the manuscript production figures, but still, you know, that period between 1448 and 72 is just such a huge effusion of manuscripts, and you know, I don't know whether there's a zeitgeist answer or what, but what is,
yeah,
what
is that? Oh, yeah, what is that? Well, it's a very good question, but I can't think of any obvious answer, you know, that makes one more probable than the others. You know, the thing that I think is not an explanation is, you know, this. Of course, we know so little about population of Europe at this time, but I don't think you can find anything that suggests sort of like more people, therefore more readers in equal proportion. I think it is something else. And I really don't know what it is. Yeah, somebody else suggests something.
How many of these manuscripts in this period are on paper as opposed to on parchment?
Oh, yeah, I mean a really large number, yeah.
Because that might be a partial explanation where you're getting an increase as more and more manuscripts are being done on paper. They'd be getting cheaper, and so you'd get that kind of increase.
Of
paper and books.
Yeah, I mean, I think that could be part of it, yeah, yeah.
Thank you. It's so amazing to me that there's still so much to know about incunables, because I've always thought of them as a little bit finite, you know, stuff that you can sort of count, and there's so much work that's already been done. And I work with a corpus of 200 titles, and then I find when I go to the libraries, I'm like, oh, I just need to ask these five questions, and then I come out of the library and I'm like, forgot to ask the, you know, the sixth question. And I'm just wondering if you could speak a little bit to the beginning incunable researcher of the kinds of questions you want to make sure to ask in a in an archive, or the kinds of things that are not in Goff or Hain or any of the other sort of classic sources, and how have you gone about, you know, collecting your data? What are the pitfalls that one should be looking out for? You know, or when you say you have notes on, you know, a certain thing or a spreadsheet of 800 entries on a certain thing, did that involve retrospectively going back, or did you start from some magical spreadsheet of 1,000 questions to ask?
No, unfortunately not. But it always is a pleasure to look at books again. And I'm the last person to be setting out an orderly way of investigating anything. It's all just kind of a cyclical coming back and so forth. But yes, there are plenty of questions about, well, the 15th century book as a whole. There's just a ton of interesting questions, investigations that can be made. So all kinds of things.
I was just wondering, in addition to the indulgences that we talked about and a few of these broadsides that you mentioned tonight, what other kinds of ephemeral printing are we, you know, really seeing starting to develop at this point or during the early 1470s?
Well, broadsides are so ephemeral as a class, although not the Cyprus Indulgence for some reason. Why the one printed by Gutenberg survives in 50 copies is sort of like a weirdness in its own right. But so many of the others, you know, are just a single fragmentary copy in a binding and so forth, that it's a little hard to be sure whether you're seeing a full range or whether you know what the typical use of broadsides for printing is. But we actually do have a very great amount of information, a lot of it from a recent German catalog listing all German incunable broadsides by Falk Eisermann, which is a wonderful piece of work. And so in there, in fact, you can very easily see what kinds of texts were printed. In fact, some of them are quasi-literary texts that could be printed both as a small pamphlet and as a broadside. There aren't a lot of them, but there are some of them. One that I find particularly interesting is there's a whole group of broadsides from southern Germany, which are invitations to shooting contests, that is to crossbow in particular, maybe some musketry competition also, where one town would decide that they would have a shooting contest and invite neighboring towns to come. And these broadsides, including made by woodcut, like a picture of the size of the mark, so that the people in the towns could practice before they came. And who would have, you know, when you think of printing in general as this God-given invention, who would think of German invitations to crossbow contests? But broadsides are just, they're endlessly fascinating.
Thank you so much, Paul. Some things are so amazing that they have creation myths sort of associated with them. And for me, printing always was one of them. And I suppose growing up, another one was the origin of the universe, and another one was the making of the human body. And it occurs to me that the making of the human body and the origin of the universe, and now the invention of printing, have this in common, that the initial conditions for what was to happen are so incredibly important in framing what happens. And the geometrical expansion of the inflationary universe and the early body and the history of printing are also incredibly important, but what happens after that is not so important. So I think sort of shedding light setting such light on the initial conditions and exponential expansion of printing in 1450 to 1475 is truly myth-busting, revelatory, and far more interesting than myth. And thank you all for coming, and thank you again to Paul for coming.